weren't insurance. They were wishes. Coins you flipped into a fountain. They got heard, or they didn't get heard, and nobody knew what they did, no matter how much they all claimed to know. In the meantime, as Cameron stood there in a contemplative funk, Tanya kept lobbing all manner of questions at Mrs. Dooley, Tanya-style, trying to map what had happened. The official story, per the Chicago Police Department, is that Antoine Custis, 34, was confronted by officers seeking a suspect in a recent armed robbery. When Custis turned belligerent and attempted to flee, one of the officers fired on him with a non-lethal beanbag round, striking Custis in the leg. At this point, Custis allegedly reached into his coat pocket, which suggested to the officers that he was reaching for a weapon. One of them opened fire, shooting Custis in the abdomen. 11 hours later, Custis died from the wounds. Inside that pocket, police said, were narcotics and a knife. A later inquiry, however, revealed the narcotics to be a single joint, which family members believe Antoine was probably trying to get rid of when he reached into his pocket, and the knife to be the same box cutter he used in his job as a receiving manager in a Southside liquor distribution warehouse.
"I got 3 great-grandbabies lost their daddy today," Mrs. Dooley was saying. "That boy, he was good. I raised him right here, and he was good. He had his struggles, but, well, y'all remember."
Whether she stopped herself due to the camera's intrusive presence, Honeybun was still filming, roaming a half-circle beside them, or because she simply didn't wish to dwell on Antoine's struggles at the moment is unclear. Fact is, however, Cameron didn't remember. Not even Antoine's name, which he was grateful to Tanya for supplying. Antoine had been 8 years older than Cameron, and thus by the time Cameron was old enough to explore the avenue, a teenager and then an adult, an unknowable figure for a kid riding a big wheel, never mind the racial divide. All he really remembered about the grandson was that he always wore a droopy Lakers jersey and sometimes sat out in his car listening to Little Bow Wow and Outkast and David Banner, with the bass cranked so high that every window on the street thrummed and fuzzed, and Cameron's mother's little porcelain figurines would tap dance on their shelves. After a while, Mrs. Dooley leveled another stare upon Cameron, this time as if waiting for him to say something, as though he hadn't answered a question she'd asked, or that as a representative of twisted fate, he had an obligation to weigh in. The first of the afternoon's raindrops splattered his forehead. "I hate the prayers didn't save him," was all Cameron could think to say. Her stare got harder and narrower, reminding him of the way she'd surveilled him as a child, pointing that crooked finger at him as though to say she knew what he was thinking, she knew what he was plotting, that she'd always be on to him.
"How come praying can do this?"
she finally said, this being Cameron up on his feet.
"But it can't save a child from bleeding."
"I don't know," Cameron said, falling silent for several beats as the raindrops multiplied. "You know I don't know. I'm sorry." Mrs. Dooley was nodding expressionlessly up at him, raindrops seeping down the canyons of her wrinkled face. She looked to be running some kind of calculations through her head, valuations and probabilities and the gut algebra of moral justice. Then her gaze widened to take in the broader tableau. Honeybun's face scrunched behind the big black camera lens. Griffin and Casey rubbernecking from the driveway. All the audiovisual equipment heaped in the open garage, enough cable to lasso the moon.
"This rain's fixing to come down," Tanya said. "Why don't I carry you back in the car, and I'll sit with you a while."
Mrs. Dooley's focus returned to Cameron.
"Cameron gonna walk me back,"
she announced. Cameron looked to Tanya, who nodded, then eased himself closer to Mrs. Dooley. She swiveled her walker around in a many-pointed turn, and without acknowledging the crew, or even Tanya, began shuffling back down the walkway.
"I'll still come on over in a few," Tanya called after her. "I just gotta throw some clothes on."
For the first few minutes, Cameron trailed a few feet behind, silent except for the order he gave Honeybun and Casey to stop following them. Mrs. Dooley clicked herself forward down the street so slowly that Cameron found it difficult to keep pace with her. His legs, once motionless, begged indifferently for a longer, faster stride. About halfway down the street, Mrs. Dooley asked, somewhat accusingly,
"What them people doing there all day?"
"They're making a show. You know that, Mrs. Dooley."
She grunted half-heartedly.
"Ain't no one told me what the show about."
"It's about what happened to me," he said, "about everything I've been doing since."
She glanced over at him, for the first time on their walk, asking,
"What's that you been doing since?"
Cameron's response took a while, a half dozen slow steps at least.
"Making a show," he finally admitted.
"Huh,"
she said. They shuffled along for a time. She asked,
"People are gonna watch that show?"
"That's the idea, I guess."
"And what they gonna see?"
When Cameron failed to answer, after another half dozen steps, Mrs. Dooley answered her own question.
"I'll tell you what they gonna see."
Her tone made unclear whom she was addressing. Cameron, herself, the asphalt, Jesus.
"They're gonna see nothing."
Cameron winced, and Mrs. Dooley, glancing rightward again, seemed satisfied at the sight.
"You don't think I see you back there,"
she said about the backyard, her taut voice rising, but studded with heavy breaths.
"Acting like you got cause to do nothing, be nothing."
She shook her head and snorted, grief and disgust crammed into one nasal honk.
"Still pouting like someone done sucked the red off your lollipop. Jesus give you a fortune, and you acting like you don't know how to spend it."
"Maybe I don't," Cameron wanted to say, but didn't. Instead, he peered down at his dragging feet, uncertain why he deserved this, but persuaded that, whatever the reason, he did. They were at her house now, the raindrops multiplying.
"Jesus didn't do what he did so's you could join the circus," she said.
This stopped Cameron, and as Mrs. Dooley turned to ascend her front steps, Cameron stood there sagging, his wetting T-shirt beginning to cling, rainwater glazing his face.
What am I supposed to do?"
he asked of her back, and waited.
"That between you and Jesus,"
was all she said, fumbling with her screen door. And she was almost inside before Cameron, dazed and slumping, thought to say how sorry he was about Antoine. Her head dipped, but she spoke no reply. Scott T. Griffin didn't try to speak to him when Cameron returned inside, which was good, because Cameron was in no mood to talk. He holed up in his bedroom, smoking so fulsomely and unceasingly that Honeybun, passing the bedroom door on the way to the bathroom, noted curls of smoke oozing from the top of the door.
"Did you pray for my grandson, like I asked you, right after you risen?"
Cameron didn't believe it mattered, certainly not to the fate of Antoine Custis. But while he remembered Mrs. Dooley asking him to pray for her and her grandson, he couldn't remember ever doing so. Thing was, he hadn't prayed at all that first night.
"Right after you risen."
He hadn't done anything that night besides dumbly reel from what had just happened to him, stupefied by the aftermath of an unfathomable magic trick. The reactivation of his faith lagged days behind the reactivation of his legs, and by then, well, by then his head had gotten crowded. By then it felt like half the world was begging for his blessing. By then, he'd just forgotten. He'd failed her, he thought. He'd failed her, and then, just now, he'd lied to her. But she'd seen right through the lie, hadn't she? Had peered directly into the void that he wasn't supposed to have anymore, then called him out on it. It didn't make a lick of sense, of course, that him praying could have changed even a stray molecule of what had happened to Antoine up in Chicago, that a prayer of Cameron's could have cauterized the bleeding or redirected the bullets or given Antoine the wits not to reach into his pocket with cops training their guns on him. That made no sense at all. Yet as he sat there on the side of his bed, sucking cigarette after cigarette, his own legs seemed to be speaking to him in a language of twitches and trembles that he couldn't help but translate as sense? Circus freak? What the hell is sense? Scott T. Griffin, for his part, sat holed up as well, in the kitchen, fuming, pecking aggressively at his laptop. The clash with Cameron had snapped something inside him. His last mental shoelace. For 4 months, he'd been working 16 hours a day on a show that was increasingly bearing little to no resemblance to the earnest and scientifically rigorous show he'd intended to make. The deadline that Bree Winterson had set for him, silly to begin with, was now making no narrative sense whatsoever. Was just a zombified marketing gimmick chasing Griffin in his sleep. His marriage had come unglued over the holiday shooting break, his affair with Caitlin Douglas exposed by an ill-timed text message, and for all intents and purposes, he was currently homeless. Moreover, his relationship with Douglas, which had bloomed under the excruciating heat of the production's deadlines, was now wilting from that same heat. As one crew member would later say, "When you're shooting with a skeleton crew like we were, your PA's main duties can't be flashing the showrunner and giving him back rubs." And now, the goddamn cherry on top. Cameron Harris, his one-of-a-kind subject, his soon-to-be star, was bucking him for just trying to mic the old lady down the street. The first bona fide moment of drama in weeks. Finally a scene that wasn't just people oohing and aahing over the sight of a guy walking through Walmart. That wasn't just a setup for some wisecrack from Tanya, or a physical therapy montage that came off like a 100-to-1 dilution of the Rocky movie's training scenes. Finally this. Resentment and sorrow under a supporting actor sky, with Cameron, he thought, finally positioned to step into his role as an unlikely pastoral figure. At the moment Griffin was viewing the footage Honeybun had uploaded for him, and he had crap for audio, he had wind whoosh and murmury garbled voices that might just as well have come from the bottom of a well or from a no-budget Brooklyn mumblecore flick. "Fuck it," he said aloud, dumping the footage file into a folder he titled, after the Gil Scott Heron song, "Whitey on the Moon." When Honeybun poked into the kitchen around 2:30 to check on the afternoon's status, he found Scotty T dourly mixing a tumbler of vodka and kombucha, something he was unaccustomed to seeing during shooting hours from his longtime boss. Though Honeybun's first thought, he says, was about the drink itself. Ew. Griffin told him they were 86ing the Christmas shit, scheduled on the call sheet. Today's vibe was all wrong for a chestnut scene, he said, and for that matter, everyone knows that Christmas scenes are only effective when they air during Christmas. It's probably no surprise that the Christmas theme was Winterson's idea. He was of a mind to scuttle the holiday dinner, too, except that he'd already placed the order for 200 oysters on the half-shell, and his bottomed-out morale didn't need to infect the crews. "So are we just going to drink until 9? Honeybun asked. Griffin tinkled the ice in his glass and shrugged. "Yippee," Honeybun said flatly. And that's more or less what they did. By the time Cameron emerged from his room, crew members say, Scott T. was sporting a conspicuous vodka buzz. He strode straight up to Cameron, threw his arms around him in an apologetic man-hug, and like opposing athletes after a game, they seemed to shake off their differences, especially after the Bud Lights started relaxing Cameron. They bickered mildly over the proper way to eat an oyster. Cameron claimed hot sauce and saltines were essential. Scott T. issued an elaborate pitch for sucking them nude from the shell, to guzzle their essence, but otherwise seemed fine. Led by Honeybun, the crew members razzed Griffin for his gnarly kombucha cocktail, with even Caitlin, her relationship with Scott T. having graduated from open secret to open affair, joining in. She forced him, Cameron and Tanya too, to throw back whiskey shots the way she said they did back home in Alaska. A joint got passed. Selfies got snapped and posted. The product placement Vitamix blender, which the Harrises had never plugged in, was given its inaugural whirl, mixing tequila with some frozen margarita mix someone fetched from the Busy Bee. Scott T. blasted drive-by truckers and Todd Snyder songs. And then for Cameron, some retro-cool southern gospel that Scott T. figured he'd dig. Caitlin tried teaching Aiden Casey some of her high school cheerleading routines, resulting in an overturned couch. It was New Year's Eve, after all, and no one besides Scott T. was older than 30. The day's call sheet, no one failed to notice, had all but been scrapped. "It was like we'd all come back from the production break," says Honeybun, "and then decided, what the hell, everybody play hooky." Except that is, For one thing, they were still heading out to Gidry's Lava Lounge, even if at this point they recognized themselves to be something less than an adept television crew.
"We don't gotta get all that much," Scott T. said of the footage they needed to shoot.
Not that herding the group toward a bar required much lobbying. A location shoot like this one comes with an array of challenges. Releases need signing, lighting can be tough, drinks get spilled on electronics, scoring a decent camera angle in a cramped dive bar can be next to impossible, audio is a nightmare, cameras get jostled, talent gets soused. Yet both Honeybun and Austin Croft, the sound mixer, had worked with Griffin on World's Rowdiest Bars, Spike TV, 2006 to 2007. Producing that show, they all felt, had equipped them with a toolkit more than sufficient, even with margaritas hobbling them, to shoot a handful of scenes in.
"What's this place called?
The Champagne Room?" Casey asked on the way, texting his girlfriend back in L.A. Honeybun, who'd scouted Gidry's with Caitlin and was responsible for renaming it on the call sheet, let out a fat burst of laughter. From the front seat he cooed,
"You'll see."
No one can explain the lava in the name of Gidry's Lava Lounge. Not even Gidry's daughter, Brianna, the current owner. The bar, up far enough in North Biloxi to have weathered Katrina, has been around since the early 1970s, leading some to theorize that the name might have had some connection with lava lamps. Others figure it was a sign painter's misspelling, though they're at a loss to cite what the intended word could have been. Curiosity about the name, however, is exclusive to newcomers and out-of-town visitors, neither of which Gidry's much attracts. It occupies an unwelcoming cinder-block rectangle set on a wide dirt lot on Old Highway 67, the only indication of life inside being a neon Budweiser sign obscured behind a barred-up and dirt-clouded porthole of a window. In the daylight, the building's maroon paint, everything's maroon, even the window bars, as though the building hadn't much been painted, as dipped, evokes the color of a fresh kidney left to rot in the sun. But daylight isn't what Gidry's is about, despite the obligatory lunch specials and the handful of tattooed old men barnacled to the bar on most afternoons. On Friday and Saturday nights, when there's live music, country rock cover bands with names like Free Beer Tonight and The Rebel Rousers, Gidry's can get magnificently rowdy. Crowds spilling out into the dusty, dark parking lot for bouts of fighting, or loving, or both. Painted over the entirety of the ceiling is a giant Confederate flag. But it's almost impossible to make it out, since someone got the idea in the 90s to shellac magazine covers over it. Mostly the cleavage and chrome covers of Easy Riders, a biker mag, but also, weirdly, a few Good Housekeeping and People covers, including one featuring Ivana Trump, decades of cigarette smoke having stained her smiling face a decidedly non-Caucasian shade. You can theoretically get a cocktail in Gidry's, but as the Miracle Man crew discovered, you really shouldn't try. When Aiden Casey ordered an old-fashioned, that au courant order of L.A. hipsters, Brianna Gidry slapped a Budweiser onto the bar.
"That old-fashioned enough for you, hon?" she said.
Gidry's is a Tanya haunt, not one of Cameron's. Cameron had only been there a few times before tonight, when Tanya would drag him in during his leaves from Fort Benning. And the way he contorted his mouth whenever Gidry's came up relayed his opinion of the place. Tanya, however, has been a semi-regular since just after Katrina, when the Point Cadet bar frequented by her and her equally underage friends got swept out to sea. It was Gidry's she was leaving in 2013 when the highway patrol busted her for DUI. The year-long license suspension that followed curtailed her visits, as the constraints of Miracle Man production did later once her license got restored. She'd been looking forward to her return tonight, though, sending group texts to friends as Caitlin drove her and Cameron to the bar, inviting them to
get your hot asses on the TV.
Certain folks at Gidry's haven't always treated Tanya kindly. A contributing factor to her DUI, she says, was overhearing some friends of a cute biker guy she was talking with that night laughing how they didn't know what he'd do with her because she didn't have a wide load sign for his bike. So Tanya was relishing tonight's homecoming, making her reappearance with a film crew in tow, Outfitted in a black Adriana Papel sleeveless lace dress the production company had bought her, with Caitlin having done her hair and makeup, and with Margarita Glee already zipping through her veins. She gave her brother's knee a giddy squeeze on the drive. He didn't respond, she recalls. He was looking out the car window, vacantly, with his cheek resting in his palm. None of the patrons was surprised to see the cast and crew and camera sweeping into Guidry's, as the deal Griffin's company had struck with Brianna called for a doorman to be stationed outside the entrance, requiring patrons to sign an appearance release before entering. True, they might have expected a more sober acting crew than the one that spilled through the doorway, but then again, this was Guidry's Lava Lounge, where the lead singer of the Rebel Rousers was known to occasionally pass out on stage. Audience members sometimes commandeered the microphone afterward for a band-backed version of karaoke, belting out Garth Brooks songs, while trying not to step on the unconscious frontman. Earlier in the day, Caitlin had delivered to the bar hundreds of silver cardboard cone hats and Mardi Gras beads and other New Year's Eve party favors, though not traditional noisemakers. Austin the sound mixer threatened her with death if she got those. The crew was glad, and in some sense relieved, spooked as some of them were about the rough clientele, to see patrons wearing them, with possibly the exception of the friend of Tanya's who'd engineered a kind of pointy brassiere using two of the hats and some fishing line from her boyfriend's truck. "She really wants to get on TV," Tanya told Honeybun. In this, she wasn't alone. Word had gotten out, and Guidry sparkled with an unusually glammed-up clientele. Young women, mostly, jockeying with one another to stay in front of Honeybun's gliding camera, sipping their drinks through straws so as not to sully their lipstick. This provoked flurries of texts from male patrons to their elsewhere bros, and by 11, Guidry's was packed way beyond fire capacity, with Caitlin forced to go searching for a copy machine because the doorman was running out of release forms. And queen of this teeming kingdom, for a brief and glorious time, was Tanya Harris. The same half-dozen of her friends who descended upon Reconfort Avenue to celebrate Cameron's recovery were there, plus a half-dozen others, massaging her with compliments about her dress and her hair and about the 30 pounds she'd lost since filming began, or that she'd been encouraged-slash-directed to lose thanks to Bree Winterson's desire to see transformation. "Seriously, girl," one of them said, with vodka cranberry-infused tears of joy on her cheeks. "You look amazing. Amazing." Tanya didn't necessarily believe this. "No matter what you do," she'd told Caitlin earlier about her hair, "it's always going to be badger fur up there." But smiling, blushing, she couldn't help feeling a little amazing. For 2 months she'd been on camera, yes, but most of that had been private domestic scenes. Her galumphing around in her sweats with Cameron, doing whatever Griffin told her to do. This felt different. This felt, she'd later say, with a speck of unintended irony, like a coming-out party, like what cotillion girls must feel making their debuts. Everyone laughed a little louder and longer at her jokes, and no one, not a soul, made jokes about her. If only the dickhead bikers were there, she found herself thinking, to get a look at her load now. Cute guys didn't look askance when she looked their way. One guy, a tattoo artist who'd inked the butterflies on her left calf, but for years had mostly ignored her at Guidry's, was suddenly hound-dogging Tanya all night, repeatedly letting slip that he was going through a divorce.
"Wonder why," said one of Tanya's friends.
Yet it wasn't all surface cheer. That afternoon, she'd spent more than 2 hours with Mrs. Dooley on her porch, helping her cope with Anne Twain's death as the rain patted the porch roof, maintaining a hand on Mrs. Dooley's bony shoulder as the old woman narrated photo albums, even fishing a couple teary laughs from her at the end about Anne Twain's young exploits. Unlike Cameron, Tanya had lots of Anne Twain memories. Something about that, the sense of fulfillment that comes from expended empathy, or the plain satisfaction that comes from leaving people better than you found them, had kindled inside Tanya a warm firefly glow. Taking care of people was what Tanya did, first her mother, then Cam, and she hadn't realized until today how much she was missing that, with Cameron now more or less independent. And this realization that she possessed not just a skill but a purpose, maybe even a calling, was only adding to the buoyancy she was feeling at Guidry's. Partly as an homage to Anne Twain, she queued up David Banner's Cadillac on 22s on the jukebox, a mellow hip-hop song dating back to before her mama died, and before Katrina hit, and before Cameron went off to Afghanistan. And with her eyes closed, Tanya began swaying, then dancing to its chill, stuttering beat, adding a fizz of nostalgia to the cocktail of emotions she was savoring. When she opened her eyes, half the bar was dancing with her, her friends in a semicircle around her, Scott T. and Caitlin grinding sloppily in a corner, Honeybun raising the roof with one hand while filming with the other, the cute if leering tattoo artist trying to snake his way toward her, someone she'd never seen before handing her a fresh drink out of nowhere, the wannabe reality TV starlets bobbing in a miniskirted tangle behind her, everyone hollering out the last line of the chorus with her, "Pray to the Lord for these Mississippi streets, hey, hey, hey." Emboldened, perhaps, by having shared the dance floor with Tanya, the wannabe starlets thronged her afterward, pleading with her to pose for selfies and group shots with them, filming her with their cell phones, and at least one of them asking her for advice on how to break into TV. Tanya's response was characteristically wry. "Maybe ask God if there ain't something he can do for your brother." Amid all this, she realized later, she'd lost track of that brother. Everyone did, except the bartenders. Cameron started drinking hard the moment he entered Guidry's, and not just his standard regimen of thermal angel blood or Bud Light. Scott T. kept buying him whiskey shots, to reseal and then seal again the detente they'd hugged out that afternoon, which led to other people buying Cameron whiskey shots, and which led, after a while, to Cameron buying himself whiskey shots. Honeybun admits, and the raw footage makes clear, that he didn't devote many megabytes to filming Cameron. Griffin, for one thing, was having too loosey-goosey a time, using bourbon to flush out the bile of his recent weeks and the earlier part of his day, to remember to direct, and the way Tanya was hamming it up kept Honeybun's camera lens glued to her. Aiden Casey sat with Cameron at the bar for a while, until some older guy engaged Cameron in a religious discussion that quickly went deep. Way too deep for Casey, at least while his head was topped with a pointy cardboard hat. Austin Croth, who hadn't been there to witness the friction between Cameron and Griffin, recalls wondering if Cameron might have still been pissed about the incident, whiskey fueling and maybe exaggerating some residual resentment. "He just started getting this coiled-up thing about him after a while," he says. "We were all pretty squiggly in there, having way too big a time dancing around and shit. I don't know that anyone was in the mood to hear a Scott tease a prick rant from Cameron, if that's what it was. That's what I figured it had to be." It wasn't until 10 minutes to midnight that Honeybun, with a panicked yelp, realized he needed his missing star for the countdown. After 2 minutes of frantic searching, he found Cameron outside, smoking by himself in a misty blue drizzle. "You're allowed to smoke inside, you know," he said to Cameron, noting even as he said it that Cameron didn't need his hometown's ordinances explained to him. Cameron shrugged dazedly. "We've got, like, 5 minutes till midnight," Honeybun told him. "You ready to put on the happy face? Pop some bubbles?" Cameron nodded as he took a long drag from the cigarette, showing zero capacity in Honeybun's eyes for putting on the happy face. Honeybun took a step toward him. "Hey," he said, finding a more sober register. "You okay?"
"Yeah, I'm cool."
Cameron shuddered his head as if to dispel something inside it.
"There's just someone in there. Someone I kind of got a problem with."
Honeybun instantly latched onto the same mistaken assumption Croth did, that Cameron was still distressed about his earlier dust-up with Scott T.
"Oh, just get over it," he said.
He did a little shuffle in the dust, trying to dance a smile onto Cameron's face.
"That was so last year. Come on, we gotta get video of you popping some champagne."
From all accounts, and from what the footage shows, Cameron seems to have rallied. Honeybun scooted him up beside Tanya on the dance floor, where Caitlin armed him with a bottle of Dom Perignon. Tanya led the bar's countdown, and Cameron, with graceful skill and perfect timing that would have mystified his sister had she paused to consider it, popped the champagne bottle just as midnight struck. The launched cork bouncing off the Easy Rider's ceiling and the champagne foaming up and out of the bottle and down Cameron's forearm. Tanya took the first swig, the champagne's fresh suds causing half the swig to come spraying from her mouth, and Cameron got the second. From every corner of the bar there was cheering, hooting, kisses, yowls. Brother and sister enjoyed a long embrace as the bottle got passed around, but in that clasped moment, their only semi-private interaction of the night, Cameron mentioned nothing to her, she says, about anything or anyone bothering him. She saw no warning signs whatsoever.
He was drunk, yeah, she says, but so was I. So was everyone.
For the next hour or so, Cameron flickers in and out of the timeline, mostly out. Cameron himself can't really account for his doings or whereabouts in the bar, though Brianna Guidry says one of her bartenders refused to serve him a shot, an uncommon event at the Lava Lounge. Casey recalls seeing him besieged by a gaggle of the same young women who'd been flocking Tanya, and him awarding Cameron a fist bump for what looked, to Casey, like a groupie buffet. Tanya spent that hour on the dance floor, her dress sticking to her from champagne and sweat, she and her friends teaching the crew the Cupid Shuffle line dance, an expression of roaring bliss fixed solidly on her face. For the first part of that hour, Honeybun locked his camera out in the SUV in order to dance, his Honeybun acrobatics briefly stealing the spotlight from Tanya. Then he got an idea. Returning with the camera, he started canvassing the patrons with a question, as much for his own amusement as for usable footage. "What miracle," he went around asking, "are you looking forward to in the new year?" Many of the answers were funny or glib, as you'd expect them to be at Guidry's at 1 a.m. A 50-something woman, cocking a thumb toward her husband, said, "Viagra!" And a notable portion of them required the intercession of parole boards more than God's hand. But Honeybun found himself surprised at how affecting some of the other answers were. A man in a biker vest talked about freeing the father he idolized from the grips of Alzheimer's. A young woman wearing a 2015 tiara talked about unlocking her 16-year-old brother from such a profound case of autism that he's unable to speak, citing her brother's condition as the reason she found Tanya and Cameron's story so inspiring, why she'd come to see them tonight. Honeybun's drifting passage down the bar ended at a man sitting alone at one end. None of the crew members recall noticing much about this man earlier in the night. Casey thinks he saw the man leaving angrily with a blonde woman at some point. They brushed into him on their way out, nearly spilling Casey's drink. He must have returned without her, Casey thinks, because when he saw the man next, he was slouched solo at the bar, looking as though he might be nursing the wounds from whatever had happened with the woman. Though the man is 28, he looks considerably older on the footage, as though hard living, or maybe just inebriation, has fast-forwarded his physical features by 10 years. His eyes are nestled in puffs of flesh, shadowed by the brim of a camouflage baseball cap pulled low over his forehead. He has a flat and slightly zigzagged nose. The white polo shirt stretched over his torso is a size or more too small, revealing a roll of white belly. A pair of athletic sunglasses hangs from his shirt collar, though the sun had been obscured, then retired since noon. As Honeybun approaches, you can see a base smile cross the man's face. It's obvious he's overheard the question coming his way, and the way he shifts in his seat suggests his answer has been prepared for a while, ready for him to uncage it. He doesn't even wait, in fact, for Honeybun to ask him anything. The man, whose name, everyone would later learn, is Tommy Landry, just pitches toward the camera, licks his lips, and says as loudly as he can,
"I'll tell you what a real miracle would be if Cameron Harris ever hooked up with a chick. He's a fucking faggot."
"Okay, wow, you're a real asshole," was all Honeybun could get out, dipping his camera down and away from the man, before Cameron appeared suddenly, and as if out of nowhere, so swiftly and so forcefully, it was like one of the faces on the People magazine covers had spat him out of the ceiling. The punch he threw knocked Landry, all 250-some pounds of him, right off the barstool. This first blow is invisible on the footage. At that moment, the camera was aimed at the sticky floor. But out of documentary instinct, Honeybun re-steadied the camera on his shoulder and skittered backward a couple yards to record what happened next. On his way down to the floor, Landry smacked the wall, and he tried using it now to scramble up onto his feet, ripping down a poster of Miller Light Girls as he climbed upward. No one really did anything at this point. You can hear a wave of excitement and laughter rolling through the bar, since the expectation was that this fight, like most bar fights, would end right there, with a single punch and then lots of entertaining braying. As well, because of the tight crowds and the way Guidry's is laid out, only the closest onlookers were aware of the combatants' identities, Cameron's in particular. Once on his feet, with his cap having been punched clean off his head, Landry swiveled toward Cameron. His face was contorted with a crazed and cornered look that might have been owing to pain, or to basic rage, or possibly to fear. No one but Cameron and Landry would understand for a while that this was a continuation of that same face-breaking fight they'd had 10 years before on the Biloxi Beach, paused but not forgotten for a decade. Jumping over his crashed barstool, Landry made a rage-sloppy, all-out lunge toward Cameron. Cameron fielded the lunge with remarkable agility, considering his blood alcohol content, but then again Cameron had been trained by the U.S. Army and was serving combat duty in Afghanistan, while Landry was serving as rush chairman of the University of Alabama's Pi Kappa Alpha chapter. Cameron feinted left, throwing off Landry's balance midway through his charge. And then grabbing Landry's right arm with his own right arm, he palmed the back of Landry's head with his left hand, and with a single snap of motion, graceful, if only in a savage way, guided Landry's face into the 2-inch-thick oak bar. Landry let out a gurgling yelp as for the second time in his life, Cameron Harris shattered his nose. The crowd made a collective leap back as Landry's face bounced off the bar, and with a beefy thud, his back slammed the floor. The amperage of violence had by now electrified Guidry's. Some people fled the fight circle, mostly women, while other people, mostly men, jostled in for a view. Cameron was on top of Landry almost the second he smacked the floor, his punches terrifyingly rhythmic. One to the ear, pause. One to the jaw, pause. One to the eye.
"Oh, my God!"
you can hear Honeybun saying, in something close to a howl. A bystander tried pulling Cameron off, but Cameron wheeled his left arm up and back, striking the bystander in the cheek and sending him sprawling sideways, enfolded back into the crowd.
"Get this cocksucker off me!"
Landry croaked during one of the pauses, before Cameron punched him square in the mouth.
"Faggot!"
Landry wheezed during the next pause, his teeth stained red, a mustache of blood above his lips. Cameron struck him in the mouth again. By this time, the footage's audio amounts to shrieks and frenzied crosstalk.
"Help him!"
you can make out a woman pleading. Another female voice calls for Tanya.
"Tanya!"
A half-dozen men jump in front of the camera lens in quick succession, the last of them staying put with his back blocking the camera.
"Get his arms!"
someone shouts.
"Calm the fuck down!"
someone else is shouting at Cameron.
"Get his fucking arm!"
to Cameron.
"It's over, dude! It's over!"
Not quite buried in the audio is Landry's voice, feeble, broken teeth clogging his throat, still saying,
"Faggot!"
The next thing visible is four men, two on each of Cameron's arms, yanking Cameron up and off Landry, their expressions so strained it appears they're unsuctioning him. Landry's hands cover his face just as Cameron's heel strikes it, a parting kick that may or may not have been intentional. Cameron struggles for a few seconds, flailing like a captured animal, until a fifth man manages to take hold of his ankle and, with a drill sergeant's timbre, screams at Cameron to calm down. Then Cameron goes limp, with his one free limb, one of those miraculous legs, dangling inertly from his body, as the five men cart him out of the bar, the stunned crowd parting, and Tanya running close behind, then Griffin, Then the crew interspersed with Tanya's friends. Then 15 or 20 people hoisting their cell phones to snap photos or record video. And then finally Honeybun, moaning something unintelligible as he records Cameron being dumped into the back seat of the production SUV, and Tanya, in her black cocktail dress, sobbing, crawling in after him. The first social media post went up even before the crew pulled out of the parking lot. Stacking up throughout the wee hours of the morning, some with shaky, noisome video, and others with dark and blurry pictures, they were all variations on this one. A Facebook post from a witness. Keith Nualet. For real, I just saw a miracle man beat the shit out of some dude at Guidry's. Among the many people who saw these posts that morning was Jesse Castaneto, the reporter for the Biloxi Sun-Herald, who's covered enough hurricanes in his career to instantly recognize one on the horizon. To spot a Category 5 shitstorm blowing straight his way. Chapter 16. From the inside of his 72 Maserati Ghibli Spider, idling out front of a mobile home at the end of the steep and sinuous dirt road he'd traveled to get here, Euclide Abasha was watching four massive dogs of a size and demeanor he'd only ever encountered before in Luca Giordano's 17th-century painting of the hellhound Cerberus guarding the gates of Hades, leaping and leaping and then leaping yet again at the car's windows. Euclide brought close to tears by the scritch, scratch, scritch of their claws carving up his doors. Compounding his distress was uncertainty that he was even at the right place. When the Google Maps voice announced, "You have arrived at your destination," he'd been looking at two mailboxes perched by where an old logging road, by the looks of it, met the country route. Happening upon a fork as he followed the road into the woods, he'd opted for the road more traveled, the Maserati's low underside aching from all the washouts and ruts, despite Euclide's efforts to baby it up the climb. Reasoning with the dogs from inside the car did nothing to calm them, quite possibly because Euclide's entreaties came out in Italian. He honked the horn. The youngish woman who emerged from the mobile home aligned with Euclide's mental image of the woman he'd spoken to on the phone the previous day, who'd identified herself as DeMarcus Lockwood's sister Chirice. Distracted by the dogs, he'd also failed to notice the wooden ramp on which she was now descending. So this must be the place, he decided, rolling his window down 2 inches. The woman clapped her hands and waved and hollered at the dogs, which stopped jumping but didn't quite retreat, running circles around the car now as though formulating Plan B. She seemed in no hurry, not walking so much as flowing down the rocky driveway in her aquamarine sock feet, dressed in bright pink pants with an unzipped sweatshirt over a jewel-studded black T-shirt. As she approached the car, she came into focus as a lithesome woman, no older than 30, slim but somehow voluptuous at the same time, and a quite pretty woman, too, as Euclide couldn't help noticing. Her face scrunched into an expression of annoyance, but also what looked like amusement, was coroned by a short, ringleted afro. Tattoos of stars ran up both sides of her neck, as though to suggest a sparkler flaring beneath her T-shirt, a firecracker of a heart. Once alongside the car, she ran her gaze across its silver contours, ignoring the driver stranded within. Euclide rolled his window down a few more inches. "Huh," she finally said, still neglecting to look at him. "I know you bad lost. Can I get out?" "I don't know," she said. "Can you? The dogs, I mean." She made a brief, tepid show of yelling at them to get back. "They ain't gonna hurt you." Once out of the car, Euclide wiped his sweaty palms on his trousers and made sure not to glance at the car door. This he could do later, when he was somewhere safe to weep. "Euclide Abasha," he said, extending his hand. She didn't take the hand, instead tilting her hips to the side and raising one arm akimbo. "Didn't we talk on the phone yesterday?" "We did," he said. "Yes, we did. And I told you not to come round." "You did, yes," he said, lowering his rejected hand.
But the nature of my work can be so complicated and strange-sounding, you see, that I feared I did not express it very well over the phone.
Nah, she said, with a deadpan shrug. You did fine.
Ah, well, Euclide broke out a grin.
Thank you.
You're welcome, she said, dryly, clearly immune to his smile. Euclide laughed, at the same time taking stock of the area. The mobile home, newish-looking to Euclide's eye, sat in a clearing of wood so tight that he wondered how anyone had gotten it up here. The hemlocks encircling it so ancient and high that the house seemed situated inside a silo. Indicating long-ago settlement was a scatter of slanted gray outbuildings behind and to the side of the house, the forest in the process of claiming some of them, a sapling poking through one rotted roof like a conquering flag. Several children's bicycles of various sizes stood leaned against the house, and a netless basketball hoop was hanging something less than regulation height on an electrical pole. Strands of Christmas lights hung blinking in the daylight. One of the dogs lifted his leg to pee on Euclide's front tire.
I imagine you don't get many visitors up here, he said to her.
Same as anybody else, I reckon, said Shireese,
nudging her shoulder in his direction as if to point out Exhibit A.
Yes, I suppose so, he mumbled, before shifting himself out of small-talk gear.
Look, I have no wish to be a pest, but if I could speak to your brother for just a few minutes, it would—
Like I told you, she cut in. I don't think my brother want to talk about the things you want to talk about.
Euclide issued an affected sigh. Would it be possible for him to tell me that himself? He threw on a dumpy, brow-beaten expression. Just to confirm. This way, you see, my boss won't make me write letters to him and mail them certified and on like that, wasting everyone's time.
Shireese lifted an eyebrow.
Sounded yesterday like your boss is Jesus.
Aha! A quick laugh came bubbling forth. He liked this woman.
In a sense, okay, I guess this is true.
Wagging his head with a mock-sour expression, he said, He's a very tough boss. Shireese assessed the situation for a while, her lips pursed and her hands still locked to her hip. Then she turned back toward the house and started casually back uphill, saying quietly, with a darting glance at the Maserati,
Jesus sure must pay you all right, though.
Despite any real signal from her, and with the four dogs drooling disturbingly close to his heels, Euclide followed. Euclide's lips fell apart as he entered the mobile home. The living room was all but covered with Native American artifacts and memorabilia. A war bonnet, tomahawks, a beaded breastplate, arrows, whorls of arrowheads under glass, paintings of battle scenes, much more. Mounted so neatly upon the fresh white walls that Euclide felt inside a gallery. That if he looked harder, he'd see tiny price cards below each item. He was dizzied by a kind of cultural disorientation he'd experienced before in the States, though never so vividly. Occupying a couch amidst all this powwow ornation, with the wide eyes and bulging neck of a bullfrog, was an old man wearing puffy orthopedic shoes and a T-shirt on which was emblazoned an airbrushed portrait of the rapper Ludacris. To Euclide's left, in the kitchen, a one-year-old girl in cornrows was banging a sippy cup on the tray of a high chair. The old man looked up from the television.
Who's this?
He want to talk to Dee,
Shireese said, scattering some Cheerios onto the tray, which the baby scooped up in little fistfuls to throw to the floor.
What for?
The old man demanded, his eyes roaming over Euclide.
Don't matter, Shireese said. Dee ain't gonna want to talk.
To Euclide, she said,
Dee's back there working. Go on, sit down, I'll get him for you.
The old man monitored Euclide, taking a seat cater corner from him, and then let out a hospitable-sounding grunt.
That there's a right comfortable chair, isn't it?
Euclide agreed it was. He asked,
Is the Marcus your son? My son?
A scoff.
No, that's my grandson. His mother, she was my daughter.
Where is she?
My daughter? Ah, she passed giving birth to Shireese. Me and my wife, we brung them two kids up. Of course, then she went and passed.
The way he explained all this suggested less sadness about these deaths than disappointment with the women in his life for their inability to stay alive.
Euclide gestured toward the walls. Are you the one who's fond of Indians?
Fond? Shit, man, that's what we are. We're Cherokee.
Euclide didn't know what to make of this claim, stifling his gut reaction to chortle at what he thought was a joke, or maybe involved a sports allegiance with which he was unfamiliar. Looking at the old man, it seemed as preposterous as Father Ace alleging he was Chinese. Then again, Americans sometimes mistook Euclide for Spanish, Portuguese, Lebanese, Greek, or more often Mexican, really any of the world's tribes of butterscotch brunettes. The grandfather tilted Euclide's direction to ask, with a confidential hush,
"Why you wanting to talk to Dee?"
"I'm just inquiring," Euclide answered, "about a man he served with in the army."
"This boy do something wrong?"
"No, not at all." A pause. "Not that I'm aware of, I mean."
"Then why are you asking about him?"
"Something unusual happened to him, medically, and I'm trying to sort out some of the particulars of his injury."
"What kind of unusual?"
"Well, he was paralyzed, and then for no apparent reason, he wasn't."
"Huh."
The grandfather moved his lips around, as if literally chewing this information.
"Can't hardly believe what doctors doing these days. You look at Dee. Hell, only half him came home. Now he'd get around better than I do. Me, I was in the 4th Infantry over there in Nam. Back then, now, they wouldn't have even tried saving Dee. No point in, man. They would have just shot him up with some morphine and tagged him for mortuary affairs. Tell you what, they work a miracle these days. That right there, that's the truth."
Despite this fresh hint about DeMarcus's mobility, and despite Euclide's familiarity with the state of trauma rehabilitation, Euclide was nevertheless taken aback by Staff Sergeant DeMarcus Lockwood's swaggering entry into the living room. From the injuries that had been reported to him, Euclide was expecting someone who looked, well, injured. But DeMarcus Lockwood most certainly didn't. Yes, the long-sleeved jersey he was wearing dangled slack where the lower half of his left arm used to be, and yes, he was walking on twin prosthetics left unconcealed by the basketball shorts he was wearing. And beneath those shorts, Euclide knew, was the residue of equally dire wounds. But no, DeMarcus Lockwood did not look injured. He looked repaired, instead. He looked bionically strapping, carrying his 6 feet 4 inches of height into the room with a jock's supple confidence. Shireese lagged behind with the tetchy face of someone who's just lost an argument. DeMarcus apologized for making Euclide wait. He'd been on a conference call for work, he explained, and you know how hard it is to beg off one of those. He parted the front curtains for a peek outside.
"Shy says you come up in some dope ride."
He nodded admiringly at the glass.
"You really come all this way from Italy?
Lot of layovers getting to this here corner of White County, Georgia."
DeMarcus Lockwood at 32 is as handsome as his sister Shireese is beautiful. Euclide, that aging batticuore, didn't fail to recognize this. He has a lustrous mahogany complexion and high, narrow cheekbones, the latter lending some credence to his grandfather's claim of Cherokee blood. He keeps his hair and beard fastidiously close-cropped, his hairline pitched perfectly level, except for the slice cut out at his right temple, a dandyish geometric flourish. He wears his sergeant's authority lightly, but it's unambiguous when it appears, not as barking, but as a quiet and calibrated pressure that squeezes you into submission. His grin, on the other hand, can be so broad and ebullient as to seem deceptively innocent, as though the kind of delight it projects cannot be manufactured so swiftly and smoothly, with every last micron of guile filtered out. He took a seat across from Euclide as Shireese passed by to fuss at the baby, the bulk of her attention, Euclide noted, sticking fast to her brother. DeMarcus breezed through an explanation of his job coding security software for Verizon. Part-time work, he said, mostly from home. The remainder of his working hours he devotes to a local non-profit, using athletics to reach at-risk youths. "The kids get a kick out of his prosthetic legs," he told Euclide, just as Shireese's other child, a 9-year-old son who is at school at the moment, gets a kick out of them.
"He says Dee got transformer legs,"
the grandfather said, with a croaky snicker.
"One time Shireese caught him outside using one of them legs for a toy gun. Boy about needed a prosthetic butt after that whooping."
To his grandfather, DeMarcus said, "Chief, you gotta clear out so we can talk."
The hell you say?
The old man twined his fingers across his belly.
I want to hear about this boy he's talking about.
Come on, Chief, said Shirese. Dee just needing some privacy. He ignored her until she flicked off Judge Judy with the remote, at which point he submitted, with a teenager's pouty shrug, letting her escort him out to the porch. When Shirese slipped back inside, Euclide observed, she did so stealthily, as if trying to elude notice by her brother or by him, a fly seeking a wall. Euclide was laying out the reason for his visit in capsule form, omitting any details about Nicholas Fahey or congregation processes and protocols. His mission, he said, was simply to determine whether there might be a temporal explanation for Cameron Harris's recovery, something other than the miracle people were touting. The way DeMarcus was tightening in his seat, Euclide interpreted as polite concentration. When Euclide finished, DeMarcus asked,
So what'd you come all this way to talk to me for?
You served with Private Harris.
A lot of us did.
You were injured with him. Euclide discerned the same subtle wince buckling DeMarcus's face that Shirese must have. From behind Euclide's chair, he heard her say, You don't gotta do this, Dee. He's just church. You don't gotta do nothing you don't want. DeMarcus's hand went up like a stop sign. Chill out, Shy. It's all good. Then he turned back to Euclide, the set of his jaw looking hard.
Yeah, he said. Me and him went down in the same blast.
Euclide pretended to jot this down in the notepad open on his knee. What he wrote instead, however, was the Italian word for sister.
La sorella?
Shirese was trying to shield her brother from something. But what? Post-traumatic stress disorder came into his mind. He knew Janice had diagnosed Cameron Harris with it, that Cameron was on a lifetime regimen of antidepressants. If DeMarcus was similarly afflicted, maybe that explained Shirese's resistance. To her, perhaps, Euclide was here as a dredger of toxic memories that had taken years to subside, a walking, talking trigger, appearing uninvited on the remote, siloed doorstep.
From the way you are nodding earlier, Euclide said gently, I take it you've heard about Private Harris's recovery.
Yeah, that's some crazy shit, ain't it?
The tone was flat, as if he was reading off a teleprompter. Perhaps to correct this, he added enthusiastically,
I mean, I guess it's some really crazy shit if you coming all the way from the Vatican to talk to me.
How did you hear?
DeMarcus hesitated, his eyes exploring the room, as if the answer might be mounted alongside the arrowheads.
One of my old lieutenants, I think that's who it was, he sent me a link or something.
Have you heard from Private Harris since then?
No, sir, I have not, DeMarcus said.
Dee,
Shirese moaned, her brother hoisting the stop sign again. Euclide paused to underline the one word in his notepad.
There went La Sorella again. Can you tell me what kind of soldier he was?
Cambo?
DeMarcus shrugged a few times as though to unwind some shoulder tendons, like a batter approaching the plate.
He was a meat-eater, man. The best kind. You could count on him for anything. You wouldn't know it talking to him. He's this quiet guy, you know, acts kind of loose. He's pretty chill most of the time. But when shit got kinetic, man, he'd light up. That's why I always liked him being a saw gunner. A lot of these guys, you know, they get out in the shit. They just open up a blossom, emptying rounds every direction. Cambo, he was smart. He was deliberate, used his eyes. He had everybody's back.
With this brief description, Euclide was already feeling some of the air escaping Janice's theory, its tires beginning to go flat.
Is there an example you could offer?
He asked, seeing if more air might leak out. Shirese was moving about the room, he noted, not quite pacing, but close.
An example. All right, I hear you.
DeMarcus sat thinking for a while. Euclide's blinking eyes prodding him before finding one.
First time he sees action will tell you a lot about a soldier. No matter how hard you train him, no matter how many times you drill him, no matter how many goddamn video games he's played, the thing you're gonna see, that first fight, that's instinct. And he don't even know himself what that instinct is, not until that first bullet misses his head. His mama gave it to him. His daddy gave it to him. His people 100 years back gave it to him. You can adjust that, but you can't flip it. You get born one way or you get born the other.
DeMarcus, reverting to sergeant mode, was looking for a sign from Euclide that he'd heard and understood this prologue. Euclide nodded. Cameron's first fight was in Pakhtinka province. We was on mounted patrol and got ambushed, he said, adding tartly, which is pretty much how every story